police photographing our license plate.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Thank you for joining us. This is Marcello Rolando, your host of the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. We have a great show for you today featuring two of the producers of the feature-length documentary Food Chains, which opens nationally on Friday, November 21st. But we'll be talking to two of the producers of Food Chains today as they attend a premiere in Napa Valley. Now, it might be a little noisy. We might have some technical difficulties with connections with cell phones, but bear with us. And again, thank you for joining us on the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is Hamilton Fish. Hamilton Fish is a producer known for Hotel Terminus in 1988, The Memory of Justice in 1976, and one of my favorites, Quiz Show, directed by Robert Redford in 1994. You may recall the included in the cast John Turturro and Paul Scofield. Welcome, Hamilton Fish. How are you today?
Pretty good. I'm currently in foggy Southern California, but everything seems to be in good shape.
We're talking to Hamilton Fish today because he has produced Food Chains, which is a remarkable feature-length documentary about the plight of those at the bottom of the food chain. You might be surprised that you probably don't even know who they are, the people who actually harvest the food that feeds the best-fed nation in the world, and that's us. Hamilton, where would you like to start?
You nailed it in your opening. I mean, it's an invisible class of people who live under deplorable circumstances, are undercompensated, mistreated in the workplace, and they produce this essential part of our daily lives. Mm-hmm. We go to the supermarket and have very little, if any, awareness of what went on to bring those tomatoes to the tomato section.
Yes.
And I think really the film, if it has one salient and particular achievement, it's to open the eyes of the viewers of the film and the audiences around the country,
mm-hmm,
to the reality of all of those hundreds of thousands of people who are involved in the food chain from, as you describe it, the earliest stages to the retail outlet.
So we should say these are migrant workers, as Hamilton is pointing out, who actually travel around the country, but certainly Florida up to central Virginia, and they travel and harvest our food that we eat. And we know very little about them, except perhaps in older movies. But Food Chains is no older movie. Food Chains is coming out on Friday, November 21st, I think, and it tells a modern 2014 story of how these migrant workers are treated. How did you discover that, Hamilton? I mean, how were you exposed to it and reached a point where you wanted to produce a documentary like this?
Well, I think all the credit for this film and the vision that's expressed in this film goes to Sanjay Rawal, the director, who originally was alerted to the condition of farm workers, not just in the tomato crop, but crops like the strawberries and grapes. And we do reference the circumstances of those other crops in the film.
Yes.
Although that is subordinated to the larger story. I wanted to just comment on your point about the migrant workers. We consider most of these people undocumented.
Yes.
They have tried over the years to assert their rights to achieve greater levels of compensation, and almost always have been greeted with the threat of deportation or some kind of retaliatory action that they're vulnerable to because of their immigration status.
Of course,
when we talk about undocumented, we're talking often about third-generation families that are the two generations of which have been born in this country.
Yes.
And so obviously the whole question of farm labor intersects with the larger immigration debate that is roiling the country right now.
Yes.
I was going to say part of the signature achievement of the immokalee workers, who are the subject of this film, the tomato pickers in Central Florida, their great achievement has been to essentially leapfrog the traditional relationship with the workers and the farmers, and to go straight to these giant retailers who are participants in the global economy, and to present them with the documentation of the conditions under which these workers live and pick in the field. And it's the large global corporations who are sensitive to their public image,
yes,
who have responded to their appeal.
Let me ask a silly question. Why is this a sudden rush, or we're just becoming aware of it thanks to movies like Food Chains? Is there suddenly an increase, and why is there an increase of migrant workers coming to work farms in America?
I would say that the great question, by the way, and it addresses a number of dynamics associated with social change. I don't have the exact figures on the population of migrant workers and to the extent that it's been stable over a period of time.
Uh-huh.
The sense that one gets of the sudden awareness of the plight of these particular workers largely a function of the timing of reporting on their success and the release of this film.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that they've been doing this for 30 years.
Yes.
And part of their success has been the discipline that they have brought to this process. They have not overreached. They have not made claims they can't deliver on. They have not represented to their members that they can achieve objectives that are outside of their capacity. And they've built incrementally and slowly over, really, at this point, 14 years of very careful, tactical, strategic negotiations where they approached Taco Bell, they approached a couple of other of the larger retailers, a couple of the purchasers, and built a strong foundation from which they then could go to an ever-increasing pool of larger international corporations,
mm-hmm,
with the credibility of having had this relationship with the companies that they signed agreements with beforehand. And this is uncharacteristic, really, of the kinds of efforts that you've seen around the country, mm-hmm, which have really been more in fits and starts. And we even now, of course, probably know most about the Cesar Chavez,
yes,
movement back in the 60s and 70s. And you know, that had a kind of meteoric burst onto the scene at the time. But the workers, the legacy of the farm labor movement that he's spearheading, are still suffering terribly.
Yes.
It's been very, very difficult, given their immigration.
And we're right back with Hamilton Fish. That was quick, no problem. It seems through, they have a history, since the 60s in, at least, of creative nonviolence and, you know, even silent hunger strikes against corporations, food corporations, huge supermarkets, specifically Publix in Florida, when we're talking about, and I guess I should mention the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW. The film focuses heavily on that, but as you were saying, you're right out there in California, and the wine industry, the harvesters, the migrant workers who actually pick the food, the grapes, the fruit, the vegetables, the tomatoes, what they're paid is minuscule. But it isn't just that. It's also their living conditions and the sexual harassment. Talk to us about that. I mean,
those are excellent observations, and they are, without question, the ugly lining beneath the surface. The modern farm labor activist does what you've described. They do picket unresponsive grocery chain. They do go on hunger strikes. They use the tools of civil disobedience to enlist the support of the consumer and to pressure the stores into paying a slight increase, but they also, as part of their toolkit, have developed a negotiating strategy around what they call the Fair Food Agreement.
Yes.
And this process addresses some of the things that you cited, the concerns about treatment of the workers in the field, in particular sexual harassment toward the women, the conditions under which the workers live at the end of the workday, sanitation, health care, education of their young. And the way that they approached this was to enlist the giant retailer, not the farmer. The farmer proved over time not to be a very effective collaborator, partly in defense of the farmers, partly because they don't really have the money.
Exactly.
Farming is boom and bust.
Yes.
And most of the time, the farmer is having trouble making back their investment on the harvest, and they're really not in a particular strong position to reward the workers or respond to these larger global concerns that have a much greater latitude. And what these workers did was they presented themselves to these large companies, and they said, you know, the circumstances under which we're working, by any reasonable standard,
yes,
should be described as modern day slavery.
Yes.
And once that point was successfully communicated, they got the attention of large companies who do not want to be publicly associated with that kind of behavior.
Exactly.
And they came to the table, and in addition to increasing the compensation, they also codified a set of standards for treatment of the workers in the workplace in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
The farmer, who is not a signatory to the agreement, is nevertheless implicated in the terms of the agreement.
Yes.
It's the farmer has to improve the treatment of the workers in the field in order to be assured that the retailer will continue to buy his product.
Yes, excellent.
So that's the genius of the new approach that
yes.
the Immokalee workers have brought to the fight for improving their circumstances and increasing their compensation.
So this is called the Campaign for Fair Food, or the Fair Food Program, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And various retailers have signed on to the agreement. Taco Bell, Burger King, McDonald's, Trader Joe's, even Walmart, which says a lot. And Whole Foods is coming on. And as you say, so the retailers, these corporations, these food corporations that say, all right, we don't wish to be a part of any form of modern day slavery of any kind. So we're going to sign on and say we're not buying from farmers who treat people that way. And that brings along the farmers and up the food chain. Who are some of the major holdouts? Who's resisting this? It seems to be logical.
Well, the film highlights the stubbornness of Publix, which is spelled P-U-B-L-I-X, and it's one of the largest grocery store chains in the Southeast.
Yes.
And our sense from a distance is that it's not really a practical basis of opposition. It's more temperamental. It's just an ownership structure that resists being told what to do by outside forces, resists the appearance of being responsive to pressure that's imposed from the outside. Feels that in some, I guess, sort of macho way, they can ride out whatever disagreeable experience having protesters outside their front gate represents. You know, they're sort of dug in, I would say.
You know, I wonder, I should mention, I have a home in Florida, and of course, Publix is the grocery store in Florida, the supermarket. I can't tell you how many times I've shopped there, and to hear this about it was very disturbing to me as I watched the film Food Chains. But I'm wondering, did anyone connected with the film ever get an opportunity to speak with Sharon Patton, who is the spokesperson for Publix?
They did not respond to overtures for appearance on the film or an interview with any of the participants in the in the process of making the film. The film does depict one such ex-farm worker, some gander, that crosses the parking lot and goes up to the door and speak to management, and he's rebuffed by security personnel.
Yes, I understand in the film we lost a little of that, but I think you're describing the hunger strike sit-in in front of Publix, and they were allowed to be there, but the police made it clear that if they tried to approach Shannon Patton, who is a spokesperson for Publix, they would be restrained in some way. Is that putting it politely or accurately?
Yes, you know, in a way, I think the public's response is self-defeating.
Yes.
I think that the demands that these workers are making are not burdensome or onerous to the company or the shareholders. We have embarked in a new era where we recognize the standing of workers, not just in this country, but around the world. The era of colonial exploitation, of low-wage marketplaces and child labor, all of the sexual harassment and sex trafficking, all of the characteristics that have been heavily documented in recent years of the underground economy and the transborder economy and aspects, unsavory aspects of the global economy, there's a much greater public understanding of these questions, a much greater public revulsion.
Yes.
There's a much greater international effort to curb this behavior, and the holdouts are not doing themselves any favor.
Exactly.
The holdouts need to participate in the 21st century, to be a part of the international family, and to contribute to the betterment of the lives of the people they depend on. And every single example that I can think of points to a benefit to the corporation that responds in this way.
Yes. Both in their hiring practices and in the way that they treat those all the way down the food chain, from distributors, farmers, harvesters. I mean, it just is, as you say, a 21st century reality.
Absolutely. And by the way, consumers have a consciousness.
Yes.
About these issues. And a company that not only conducts itself in a manner with integrity, and in compliance with these internationally accepted standards, will reap the reward of a more loyal customer base that has a personal pride.
Yes.
In, participating with a company that is known for doing the right thing.
Exactly. It's just mind-boggling to think that anyone would just resist it. What is it? Is it they're asking a penny per pound more? Is that the...
A penny a pound, which to us seems pitiful and in fact to the bottom line of most of the larger corporations involved is not a meaningful economic concession.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more, it just runs against their practice of being told what to do or being forced to do something that is someone else's priority.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of runs in some respects counter to a kind of strain in American life, which celebrates the individual and the pioneer and the resistance and the resilience, and it just needs slowly to be re-educated.
Yes, and I think this film, your film, Food Chains, goes a long way to educate all of us in a way that we need to be educated. And I think also it's certainly not going to stop with CIW in Florida and Publix, but it's education has a way of being borderless, let's say. So it will move across the country. You do mention in the film Napa Valley and wine grapes growing and chicken farms even. So I'm looking forward to seeing this set a huge example. We should mention again, it opens Friday, November the 21st. And also, let's give a website, www.foodchainswithanSfilm.com and facebook.com/foodchainsfilm. And what's your Twitter? What is it? @foodchainsfilm. FOODCHAINS film, FILM. And some of the other people involved, names that we might recognize as well. Forrest Whitaker is the narrator, and Eva Longoria, and Eric Schlosser. Eric Schlosser being the author of Fast Food Nation, are both executive producers.
They're both in the film.
Yes.
The film, and they've both been stalwart supporters of this project, and we wouldn't be where we are today without their help.
Fantastic. And you feeling optimistic about the impact? Because it seems to me the film hasn't even been released yet, and it's already having an impact. But what do you feel about its impact on the public?
I think that we've been treated to a lot of pretty dismal and demoralizing news about the status of workers generally for
uh-huh.
quite a long time. And when a story comes along where it's apparent that through their own discipline and industry, they have succeeded in significantly improving their circumstance, I think people respond very favorably to this. It's
mm-hmm.
heartwarming, it's encouraging, it's positive, and it gives people a model. It reminds them that it is possible to achieve social progress, that we're not always under the thumb. And I think in that respect, it's kind of an inspiring project and has been received in that respect.
And I certainly agree. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Hamilton Fish, who's a producer of Food Chains, and it's been an excellent and educational and inspiring conversation. Thank you so much, Hamilton, for being on the show today. And all the best to you.
Well, thank you very much for giving it so much time and attention. It's extremely important. Thank you.
Thank you. Best to you. Bye now.
Bye.
Stay with us. We'll be right back with our second guest today, who is also a producer on the feature-length documentary, Food Chains. We'll be right back.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. At Sundance, there comes a point when a film that doesn't take itself too seriously can re-energize a tired, film-saturated audience. Back in 2010, Boy provided that needed comedic refresher. Set in New Zealand and steeped in Maori culture, Boy is the story of an 11-year-old lad named Boy. That's right, just Boy. Boy is essentially raising himself and coping with responsibility for his younger siblings, the pervasiveness of pop culture, girls, and now another grown-up kid, his own dad. The man has been in jail. But Boy believes otherwise. Dad is cool. He is steeped in modern culture, and he says he knows Michael Jackson. And in this poor, isolated backwater, a big black car can govern a child's idea of coolness. But the truth is a bit of a disappointment. Returning only to retrieve a hidden stash of stolen money, Dad lives out his fantasies as deeply as Boy. One viewer has described this endearing little film as the story of three boys, one grown up, learning to reconcile fantasy with reality. But Boy is so much more, a standout gift of pure heart, topped with a bow of unique and insightful good humor. Boy, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with my second guest today, Simriti Keshari, who is also a film, TV producer, photographer, and storyteller who loves adventure, by the way. And she's one of the producers on Food Chains, the feature-length documentary about the coalition of Immokalee workers. And well, it's about everyone who is trying to make life better for the food chains at the bottom, where the people actually pick the food that feeds the best-fed nation in the world. Simriti, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm in Napa Valley, so not many complaints.
Yeah, exactly. It's still a little noisy behind you, but you. I've been telling everyone that the film Food Chains opens on Friday, November 21st, but you guys are doing a sort of a pre-opening tour. Is that what's happening? You're out in Napa Valley for that?
We're at the Napa Valley Film Festival tonight. The film still opens nationwide on November 21st, and kind of all of our efforts are really on promoting that. We have a couple of select advanced screenings and premieres. Uh-huh. So we're really excited for that November 21st. It's all around the country, and we're really getting a partnerships and organizations to kind of do as many group sales and partnerships and buyouts just to storm the theaters.
Of course. Where do you go from Napa Valley?
Well, I go to Austin. We are very excited to be part of the Doc Night series at the Austin Film Society. Uh-huh. I'm a huge fan of theirs. So we're screening there, and then we have great speakers in that panel, Sylvia Perez from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and Tom Philpott from Mother Jones, and Lou DeBose of Washington Spectator. And then from there, it's our LA premiere.
Wow.
A road show.
It is. It sounds exciting. Are you more or less based in New York City, or are you bi-coastal, or you go where the work is?
I am based in New York City. Sanjay, the director, and I are—we're both from New York.
Yes, we talked to Sanjay last week. It was an excellent conversation, and enjoying this one with you as well. Tell me, as a producer, how did the film begin? How did it all get started? How did it come to your attention?
Yeah, well, you know, Sanjay actually brought this to my attention. We're both filmmakers in New York, and his dad's background is in agriculture.
Uh-huh.
And I think for both of us, and I think for a lot of people around the country right now, there's this incredible interest in food. And we're asking a lot of conversations for the first time as a country about the sustainable practices, the treatment of animals. And yet we realized, you know, back in 2001 that not much conversations or questions were being asked about the workers.
Yeah.
How are they treated? Who are the people that pick our food? What are the conditions like for them? And so we really started off to get to the truth of that further. Around the same time, the wonderful, wonderful author Barry Esterberg wrote a book called Tomato Land the tomato industry. I'm sure you're very familiar with Barry's work. And you know, alongside him and Eric Flusher, the author of
Fast Food Nation.
Uh-huh. Yep. Mad and Reefer Madness in the most recent Command and Control.
Yes.
alongside, you know, we really, you know, set out to speak with everyone who was involved with it, from farm workers to farmers to contractors to organizations on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from coast to coast, there we heard stories of abuse and exploitation, and yet when it came to the solution, the road always led us to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers,
uh-huh.
a group of tomato pickers from Immokalee, Florida,
yes.
who had created the Fair Food Program to really get the largest supermarket chains and fast food retailers to pay a penny per pound more and make sure that there were no human rights abuses in their supply chain.
Mm. This is—it's fascinating. I mean, I've been certainly looking into this since I saw your film, Food Chains. And the more I hear, and the more conversations I have on and off radio, the more I'm I'm inspired to believe and optimistic that as the American public becomes aware of what's in your film, they're going to change things. The consumers are powerful people. But back to the making of the film itself. How did you shape the narrative? You are a storyteller, and I believe that, and having seen some of your work, but this was quite an undertaking because the magnitude of it, and not only in the subject, but in the number of people who are affected by it, as from consumer to the supermarket to the migrant workers themselves, how do you frame that narrative so that it's not just a stream of interviews, which this isn't? How do you do that?
No, that's a really good question, and that was kind of, we had a wonderful editor with us, Aaron Barnett, and one of the things that we really wanted was to obviously, you know, make an entertaining film and make sure that there's one that had journey and movement and that there was kind of a journey throughout the arc of the film. And there was a lot of information that, you know, we felt like we needed to convey to get a context of history and legislation and to really inform audiences of, like, who all the players were.
Yes.
There are so many questions that I think people ask and are curious about how it led to this point. When we were at the fest, when the CIW was fasting for 5 days in the headquarters of Publix, really trying to get Publix to just speak to them, you know, and to have a discussion. I think it was an emotional journey in a way, and
yes.
we really felt kind of like the battle right there firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to shape the narrative around the 5-day hunger fest.
Yes.
And really allow kind of viewers to understand some of the infrastructure of the agriculture system throughout that. The government side, the historical side, the corporate side.
Yes. And I guess we should mention, for those who don't know, I've lived in Florida, but not everyone knows about Publix. Publix is not that known. That's Publix. It's a giant supermarket. It's not as well known outside of Florida, but if you want to buy groceries in the entire state of Florida, you go to Publix. So this is a huge undertaking for underpaid, unrepresented migrant workers to actually stage a hunger strike and ask to be heard. I got the impression from your film, they're just saying, listen to us, we have an idea, a win-win for everybody. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, you know, a win-win-win. Farm workers win because they get a livable wage and better working conditions and their dignity, really. Farmers win because they are able to know that, you know, the behavior on their supply in their farms are just and fair, and it creates more sustainable practice for them. And for supermarkets, knowing that, you know, they're part of a system that's effective and that there is no human rights abuses that are happening there. And, you know, for Publix, as you mentioned, it's Florida's largest supermarket chain and one of the largest in the world.
Yes.
And they earn $26 million in revenue, and it's a penny more that the farm workers are asking, a penny more per pound, and, you know, and to have them sign the code of conduct.
So basically, there is now, or some people have agreed to come to this agreement, and the agreement is called the Campaign for Fair Food, or the Fair Food Program, where the CIW, Coalition of Immokalee Workers, has asked retailers to buy only from people who treat those who work in the fields fairly. It isn't even just about money, it's dignity, it's about self-preservation, it's about some kind of decent housing. 16 people living in a trailer won't cut it. It's also about protection from sexual harassment. So it's a big picture issue, and I just can't help but wonder, I know you've had quite a few people have been affected by the film, as well as CIW retailers who are saying, okay, we want to sign on to this, but why do you suppose Publix won't even talk to the CIW representatives?
So great point that you make. You know, the kind of the simple thing that the CIW realized is that if you raise wages and enforce laws, exploitation ends. And what they're asking is, you know, through their Fair Food Program, just to ensure that the basic human rights of the men and women in the field, and these are, you know, as you mentioned, it's the right to safe working conditions, to water and shade, to work free of sexual violence and forced labor,
yes,
which is really kind of a new model for human rights in the global supply chain. And what's incredible is that the Florida tomato industry has completely transformed, and
yes,
they are really... it's a revolution that's happening in America's field, and it's a peaceful one. And it's absolutely shocking to us that the Publix won't come to the table, that Publix refused to during the hunger fast, just take 15 steps in their front lawn to where the workers were fasting. And we don't know. We don't know. And we ask all of Publix's consumer to ask them the same question, to ask them to speak to the CIW. And, you know, it's a matter of when, you know, not
yes,
if.
Yes.
Because the reason why the model is unique is because it uses market consequences. It uses the economic consequences to drive good behavior. And we all know that, you know, retailers and big businesses are really driven by their consumers.
Exactly. The consumers have the power here, and I think that's one of the very smart tactics on the part of CIW, that it is nonviolent, and it's creative nonviolence as well. And what they're saying is they're not only speaking to the big retailers like Publix, but not only Publix, Kroger, Safeway, at the top of the food chain, but they're also, by this peaceful, nonviolent protesting or requesting of being recognized, they're asking to be heard. They are also educating through your film, Food Chains, of course. They're educating the public to, as consumers, to say, hey, do you really want to support financially a corporation, an institution, a retailer that supports this kind of inhumane treatment of people at the bottom of the food chain? And once, you know, I've seen it time and time again, once Americans get the big picture, once they go, wait a minute, you mean I'm buying from a store, whether it's a clothing store, a food store, a toy store, where they use sweatshops, or they don't give them a decent working situation, that's where the consumer power comes, because the American consumer doesn't like being a part of that kind of food chain, forgive the pun. Are you finding that the public, well, I guess, I know the film already has an impact. I mean, it hasn't even opened, really, but it's, how do you explain the rippling effect it's having already?
Yeah, well, you know, it's incredible, and that's why we are very lucky to have the support of our exceptional executive producer, Eva Longoria.
Yes.
And Eva's been involved with this issue for a while. She was the executive producer of the film La Cosecha about child farm workers.
Yes.
And it's great. She was just on Bill Maher last week, and she was on Seth Meyers. She's going to be on the Colbert Report. And just kind of, you know, using sort of her presence to really bring this further and further into public everyday conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the unique things about this narrative is that we present a solution, and we present that a new day exists in tomato fields, and that that can be replicated across the board in other fields and other crops.
Yes.
And I think we really want people to know, you know, oftentimes it's the shock value is always the issue, or it is always like in highlighted for us. It's really, it's a more simpler question that consumers can ask, which is why won't you already be part of something that's effective to the retailers that aren't a part of it?
And since we've mentioned Eva Longoria, we should also mention that the author of Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser, is also an executive producer, and Forrest Whitaker narrates. So you've got some recognizable names in support of what you're doing, and everyone should want to support it. It's just astounding, and I have to say, I plead guilty, as I'm sure most Americans just didn't think about it, and that's why your movie, Food Chains, is so important. How about some of those, the retailers who have joined the Fair Food Program, who have signed the agreement not to buy from farmers who don't treat those who work for them properly? Taco Bell, for instance, Burger King, McDonald's, Trader Joe's, even Walmart, I understand. That's quite a feat.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's incredible. One of the things that you were saying earlier, kind of as a consumer, how can people know? The CIW waited 5 years to create the Fair Food label.
Uh-huh.
And the label, which is going to be rolling out in the fall in Whole Foods and then select Compass cafeterias around the country.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, it's to show this kind of visual representation of humane worker treatment.
Yes.
And what's been really incredible is to date, there have been 15 million in premium paid to workers, and there's been 600 worker complaints, and about 100,000 workers in the field have received material to know what their basic human rights are.
Wow.
And this is something that did not exist before. And right now, the most progressive labor initiative that's happening is happening in the tomato fields of Florida, and I think that's really kind of revolutionary in a way.
Yes, and it's a launching pad. It's the problem has been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to address it and was not allowed to really completely address it under the New Deal for farm workers anyway. As sad to say, because farm workers then were primarily black, and the Southerners would not give them human rights. And that's a point we want to make. Even though we are talking primarily about non-documented migrant workers who are here working for, you know, providing a service, that the kinds of jobs that we would not do, this is not so much an immigration issue as it is a human rights issue. And I think that's something Food Chains makes clear. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exploitation has always existed in farm work.
Yes.
And it's a factor of low wages and not having a roadmap to express complaints.
Ah.
It's not an immigration issue. It's a human rights issue.
Yes. Yes.
And the exploitation of workers is one, you know, in the U.S., hundreds of U.S.-born farm workers have been freed from modern-day slavery in the last 10 years. So this isn't, you know, just about whether someone's documented or not.
Yes, exactly. And you're out in Napa Valley, which is also apropos because the film, though it focuses on the tomato migrant workers in Florida, the CIW, it really also makes it clear that this is in other areas, including Napa Valley and the vineyards and those who have to pick the grapes. And what is it, 25 cents to produce a $40 bottle of wine? There needs to be certainly some sort of balance there that is not there now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in Napa, you know, one of the greatest things about Napa and the wine industry is that it does pay more to workers. But compared to how much more they're being sold, the products being sold,
yes,
wine is really, it's a premium, it's a luxury product. It's one of the things that is about kind of attitude. And we really want to showcase that charity isn't an option. And
yes.
And how the attitude needs to be of really understanding what the workers need and how to be able to provide better working conditions, be able to have that roadmap to create an environment where they're getting paid fairly and they're able to be integrated and a part of that society.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the word charity, because while it's wonderful that people do these fundraisers and give to those who need help, I'm certainly not negating the importance nor the generosity of that. And Americans can be extremely generous with charities and those in need. But I think the message of food chains is one of the many, actually, is that the migrant worker is here because of conditions that have been created in their country that makes it necessary for them to go to other countries to work, to earn money, to support their families. And what they're really asking for is an opportunity to make a decent wage, not be handed a Christmas a check once a year. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you said that, because that actually happens, yes? I mean, Publix, the very people who are resisting this CIW and the Fair Food Program, gives away turkeys at Christmas time, but won't come to the table and talk to the people who are just saying a penny per pound more.
Yeah, you know, I think that in other parts of the country, there is sort of this distrust towards farm workers. Like, if we give them charity, you know, we're kind of doing our part. And I think it's like, if we raise wages and improve working conditions, then farm workers will be able, you know, have their own pathway to be able to have, you know, to be able to create and have a community for their own family where they are able to continue on as American citizens, because they are, or as Americans, because they are contributing to our economy and our society. And I think instead of kind of looking at that charity way, it's really providing them with that same roadmap that the rest of us have.
Exactly. Well, how can people see the film? I mean, we want to be, especially the consumer, the buying consumer, going to the grocery store and in Florida, Publix, in other areas, the mid-Atlantic states, it's Kroger's, but Safeway is everywhere. How can the consumer, who has this buying power to change corporate minds, be a part of the solution? And I think the first part of becoming a part of the solution is seeing food chains. So how do we see it?
We encourage everyone to go see Food Chains. It opens nationwide, you know, across the country on November 21st. The information of the theaters is on our website on foodchangefilm.com.
Mm-hmm.
And also on our Facebook and Twitter, you can kind of find updated information as it's coming through. It's facebook.com/foodchainsfilm. And same with Twitter, it's foodchainsfilm. One of the other ways is people can have kind of a theatrical on demand. And so if the film is not in their city or in their local theater, they can demand that it's brought there and get their local community and organizations to join and come to the theater. And we're also on iTunes at Cable VOD. iTunes on November 21st and Cable VOD on Thanksgiving Day.
Fantastic. So how's Napa Valley before we go?
Napa Valley is really beautiful. This morning, the sun was kind of coming up through the mountains, and we're really excited to bring the film here.
Wonderful.
I think, you know, Napa's doing some really great work and really allowing this to be sort of a conversation towards that, the right direction.
Uh-huh.
The growers of the Napa Valley have been great, and we've had good conversations with them. So really kind of looking forward to tonight.
Very good. Well, I wish you all the best tonight and in Austin, and of course on November 21st, the opening of Food Chains. We've had a wonderful time talking to one of the producers of Food Chains, Simriti Kirshari. I may have almost gotten it right that time.
Thank you, Marcella.
Thank you. All the best. Okay. Take care. Bye now.
Take care. Bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Orson Welles was undoubtedly one of the greatest film artists of the 20th century. But ironically, apart from his masterpiece, Citizen Kane, he may be best known for one he did not direct. The Third Man was directed by Carol Reed and shot in 1948 in the war-ravaged streets and sewers of Vienna. With a brilliant score by Anton Karas on zither and a supporting cast that included Joseph Cotten and Vali, once called the most beautiful woman in the world, Welles stars as elusive war profiteer Harry Lime. Roger Ebert, adding the film to his greatest movies list, named Lime his favorite villain. Orson Welles was clearly the key to the overwhelming suspense achieved in The Third Man. Reed was heavily influenced by his expressionistic use of tilted lenses and exaggerated light and shadow. The irrepressible Welles even contributed some of his own dialogue, most notably in the famous Ferris wheel meeting.
You know what the fellow said. In Italy, for 300 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, and they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what do they produce? The cuckoo clock.
The Third Man. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. State of our Union, racism and rape, yes. Immigration reform, hell no. Generations after generations embrace, succumb to, or master their own weapons of mass destruction, so powerfully hashtagged, we self-distract with Instagram. From ears ringing out the cries of gunshots victims, our wisdom diffused by selective sight, clouded by summer and tear gas smoke, so rigorous in our southern border tastes, we're inflamed, fearing losing something we never wanted. Hyperlinking hot air rhetoric with blustering inaction, dishonoring both past and present, without shame, conservatives steep our national integrity into the depressed state of our union while blaming the help for the stench of our golden rule in rigor mortis. Ask victims, not perpetrators. Amnesty. Ask your undocumented lawns keeper. Pride. Ask those who clean our toilets for minimum wage. Human rights. Ask migrant farm workers. Self-esteem. Ask women paid less than men for the same work. Financial stability. Ask students overwhelmed by banks. Life. Ask those found guilty of neighborhood. Net neutrality. Ask parents of children dead by bullicide. Do we really believe it's the accident of birth that guarantees the least of these our brethren the indignities of discrimination, bullying, rape, and murder by a racist police state, drugged and beaten by household names, alcohol-induced raped by fellow students? Whomever the perpetrator, the targets are the same, and as purposely chosen as those who were served up to bad mortgages and selected bankruptcy. Credit score reporting. When home of the brave citizens disintegrate from culture of character to culture of stonewalling, our little brown brothers, from having work we wouldn't stoop to conquer, our Congress reflects hypocrisy of corporatism-stamped conservatives. American power is diminished when Americans turn away from those traumatized by poverty, bullying, unjust imprisonment, rape, and racial discrimination. Sadly, it's too late to ask the amazingly talented gift to America, immigrant Mike Nichols. But immigrants still work all around us, trying like us to support families, but unlike most of us, doing so by harvesting the food we eat and cleaning up after we eat it. As rite of passage, each nationality reaching our shores was prejudiced against by the immigrants who came before. Yet each shared in our history. Pearl Harbor, Cuban Missile Crisis, 9/11, Katrina, Boston bombing. But since the Reagan administration, conservatives like Koch Brothers, BP, and Jim DeMint's Heritage Foundation have been allowed to turn us into sitcom characters with mind-numbing, truth-twisting TV ads until we glaze over like holiday turkeys. We remember November 22nd, 1963, as the day President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated, but ignore June 11th, 1963, the day he proposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to the 88th Congress. Can we not now insist the 113th or 114th Congress pass an immigration reform bill as a moral human rights issue, rather than their vacation political football? Let's turn our back on Boehner hypocrisy and treasonous one-term president anti-American Mitch McConnell rhetoric and step up for families forced into hiding and women forced to endure the trauma of rape in silence. Let us free ourselves from imprisoning people guilty only of their skin color and resuscitate our Ellis Island promise. Let us salute the patriotism of a U.S. Marine Corps Captain Derek Herrera rather than preserving the 19th century prejudice of conservative Mo Brooks. Let us be courageous enough to share the home of the brave, rather than cheer a House of Representatives that divides us. Let us give thanks to Native Americans giving us our first Thanksgiving, rather than deny races racing to contribute to our land of the free melting pot. Let our free will keep Lady Liberty's torch alive, instead of branding ourselves the Great White Hope. Executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government are charged with being the humane and equitable voice protecting our republic, especially perhaps from extremists abusing democracy by victimizing the vanquished. We keep our humanity safe by saving each other, or we follow Cain and live the murderous consequences of conservatism. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.